From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
Un giovane macellaio comincia a 13 anni.
A young butcher starts off around 13 years in Italy.
A 13 anni, un adolescente sogna tutto nella vita.
And a 13-year-old, as you know, dreams of just about anything in life other than taking over his dad's work. Knowing that there were seven generations passed down from father to son ahead of me was nearly a nightmare. But I'd grown up in the shop. I was born in the house across the street from the butcher shop. And that little piece of the world, the house, the narrow road, the shop across the street, that was my world.
Dario Cecchini didn't want to be a butcher, yet he has become, without argument, the most famous butcher in the world. He lives and works in Panzano, a small town in Tuscany where he runs the local butcher shop, just as his family has done for seven generations before him. But he doesn't live a small town life. Antica Macelleria Cecchini is a place of pilgrimage for people who love great food from all over the world. It's a place where you're as likely to find opera as you are AC/DC blasting through the stereo. Dario joins me this morning with his wife, Kim, who will be his translator today.
Benvenuto.
Grazie.
It's wonderful to have you. So when your father died, I understand that you were studying actually to be a veterinarian, which is a very interesting choice coming as the son of butchers.
Era una scelta che apparteneva a quel mondo.
In a way, it was a choice that made sense within that world because it was my desire to help people who raised animals that we used to raise them better and to help them have a better life.
Era interessante anche perché
in the countryside, a veterinarian in the end took care of not only the animals, but also the simple folk who took care of those animals. And so veterinarians were very often people doctors, and my veterinarian that I knew was my doctor.
So this moment happens where you watch your father fall ill, the one person you had left, and you yourself make the decision to step into that shop. Was it a decision that you were finally able to make with total surrender, or did you fight yourself a lot when you first went in there?
Era un obbligo.
It was an obligation.
E come tutti gli obblighi, non era una scelta.
It was not a choice. It was a moment that I had to accept the path that life had dealt me and to give up my dream.
What was your dream at that point?
Il mio sogno era di diventare un veterinario.
I dreamed of becoming a veterinarian and to having a life that was different from the life that my parents had led.
Had all of these generations before you in the butcher shop, had it always been a nose-to-tail operation?
Hanno fatto dal naso alla coda perché era necessario, perché
nose-to-tail was something that happened naturally back then. The richer folks in town bought the fillets, they bought the steaks, and the poor folks in town bought most of the rest. Because little town, small market, it just worked out naturally that way. The only way we knew was nose-to-tail.
In the shop, you don't only sell raw meat, like many butchers do, but you also sell food that's been cooked.
C'è il negozio e ci sono due ristoranti insieme al negozio.
So in the shop we sell some parts of the animal and other parts of the animal. We cook and we serve in our two restaurants. And this way, we're able to use the whole animal well. A butcher takes on the responsibility for the entire community of killing. Butchery represents the most delicate link in the food chain. It's the biggest responsibility maybe that anyone in the food world takes on. For me, that responsibility starts with thinking about the life of the animal and guaranteeing that it has good space, a good life, good food. That the animal then has as compassionate a death as possible, and that every part of the animal is used in the best way. But that's not enough. We always have to remember to thank the animal for the gift it's given us. And for me, the best way to thank the animal is to share the meat that the animal has given us at a convivial table all together. In our restaurants, we sit down all together at the same time with one menu, and it's a set price. This is my way of creating a sharing environment for dining together. It's a Renaissance tradition, really, a celebration of life.
When people come into the shop to buy a bistecca fiorentina, do you make them purchase another part of the animal?
Io non impongo, cerco di spiegare.
I don't make them, I try to explain. If somebody wants a bistecca alla fiorentina, I ask that they telephone ahead and give me a couple of days of time to set one aside for them. The bistecca alla fiorentina is just one part of the entire animal. And so I do ask that people, when they purchase a bistecca alla fiorentina, that they also walk away with a bistecca panzanese, which is a special cut from Panzano. I consider both of these cuts to be noble cuts. They're both fantastic, cooked on a grill. The clients seem to appreciate that we together are taking responsibility. And I think that this helps them to recognize that the quality that they find in my shop doesn't have only to do with the meat, but also with the service and the thought behind the service. I explain this dilemma to my clients, and that allows them to become part of the solution. I explain that the dilemma is
to beef or no to beef.
Is there a cut of any animal, not just beef, that you would love Americans to know about and use more?
Vorrei che tutti.
What I would like is that Americans, but not only Americans, recognize that the world of meat is not shaped like a pyramid, where the very tip of the triangle is a fillet, a fancy steak, and that somehow as you move through the other cuts of the animal, you're finding cuts that are less good. I would rather prefer that they think of meat as a harmonic circle, where every single cut is equally excellent if it's cooked well. One of my favorite recipes that we cook and serve in our restaurant is called tenerumi in insalata. It's a boiled beef salad. I start with beef knees, and I boil them in the simplest way possible with carrot, onion, and celery. I then pull the meat off the bone, and I serve it as a warm salad with julienne, and carrot, celery, and onion raw. I don't make a point of explaining this is boiled beef knees before my guests start eating. I come through, I say, did you enjoy that dish? And they say, it was fantastic. What the heck was it? Beef knees, I say, it was just beef knees. And they say, oh, that's amazing. I had no idea you could even eat that. For me, this is part of the experience of coming to the butcher shop and sitting down for something to eat. It's not a voyage just grabbing your car and driving out there. It's a spiritual voyage even once you sit down. And maybe the people that come have a chance to find a harmony for themselves.
Thank you so much, Dario.
Grazie.
Dario Cicchini is an eighth-generation butcher. His shop, Antica Macelleria Cicchini, is in the small town of Panzano in the Chianti region of Italy. Check out my Facebook page to learn more about Dario. We've got a link to a video of him in his shop that will just make you want to jump on the next plane to Tuscany. Coming up, what uses 50% of our land, 80% of our water, and 10% of our energy budget? Food, of course. So why are we throwing so much of it away? We're going to get real about food waste next.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
Welcome back to Good Food. Getting food to our tables is resource intensive. It uses up 10% of the total U.S. energy budget, 50% of our land, and most shockingly, 80% of the fresh water that's consumed in the U.S. Yet, 40% of food in the U.S. goes uneaten. That is more than 20 pounds of food per person per month. These numbers are hard to swallow. And we at Good Food wanted to find out what can be done to curb these inefficiencies. Dana Gunders is a food scientist at the National Resources Defense Council. She's worked to identify losses at every level of the food supply chain. Hi, Dana.
Hello.
You know, food waste has always bothered me, but I don't think it was until I really understood how much water we were throwing away that something deep inside me just sort of cracked open.
Absolutely. And I think particularly in this time in California where we're all just really feeling this drought, the idea that so much water is going to grow food that ultimately never gets eaten is, it's really a tragedy. For instance, if you throw a hamburger out, that's the equivalent of taking a 90-minute shower in terms of the water that was required to produce that. Of course, not all food is equal, and therefore not all food waste is equal. So if you were to throw an apple out, that's more like a 7-minute shower.
So let's talk about how big a problem it is. How much food, maybe in dollars, is being wasted a year? And where is all that uneaten food going?
Well, across the economy, about $162 billion worth of food actually never gets eaten. And that's everything from fields on farms that don't get harvested for one reason or another, to potatoes on your breakfast platter that you get left there, to the lettuce that's going bad in your fridge, and all sorts of other steps in between. And I think what makes this a challenging problem is that there's not one grave, silver bullet that's driving it. It's really happening in little bits and pieces all over the food system.
I understand that there's actually 5 different stages of loss in this supply chain. Can you go through them and maybe identify for us what area is the biggest concern?
Sure. Well, when you look across the supply chain, you know, from farm to fork, you see the biggest losses really in a few areas. One is on farms, particularly when you're looking at fresh fruits and vegetables. And then the other is more at the consumer end, so that, and both in our homes and then also in restaurants.
What would cause there to be waste at the farm level?
On farms, and I think it's important to note that the waste is happening on farms. It's not necessarily the farmer's fault, but really they are reacting to market mechanisms that are driving it. So if you're a farmer and you're growing, let's say, broccoli, you don't know when you plant that broccoli how much it will sell for when it's time to harvest. And the price of broccoli could be $6 a case or it could be $32 a case. And if it's $6 a case, it actually will cost you more to get that broccoli off the fields than you would make. And so sometimes it's just plain economics. At other points, it's cosmetics. Let's say peaches, for instance, can have a little bit of a scar. And if they have a scar, they will never make it to market. There are standards that are there to prevent anything that doesn't look quite perfect from getting to the grocery store. And, you know, I had one peach farmer tell me that of all the peaches that he can't sell, which are about 200,000 pounds a week in the height of his season, he said, you know, 8 out of 10 of them, you wouldn't even be able to tell me what's wrong with them.
Let's talk about waste in the home. What accounts for most of it?
Well, you know, I think if you just kind of reflect on the last week or two of your life, you'll see that there are a lot of little details that wind up leading to food waste. I know for me, it's part of it is just having a very busy lifestyle. So I have the best of intentions when I'm at the store. I think of a couple meals that I'm going to make, and then the week happens, and all of a sudden it's Thursday. I haven't gotten around to it. I'm exhausted, and I'm ordering takeout. You know, so I think just our dynamic lifestyles can really lead to waste. And what that boils down to is when you're shopping, being more realistic about what your week looks like and what you're really going to have time to cook. So being able to plan your meals better, really understanding how to store food so that it lasts longest, thinking about freezing food so that when you know when life happens and you don't get around to eating it, you can pop it in your freezer and have it later. And then, of course, remembering to go back to your freezer and eat it at some point in time.
What about expiration dates? I mean, I feel like as a chef and someone who had a restaurant, I really understand how long food can last, especially when it's properly refrigerated. And I think a lot of people are really afraid of that expiration date.
It's so true. The majority of consumers in this country think that expiration dates are telling them to throw food out. In fact, that's actually not what they're even designed to do. They're not federally regulated. There's only one product that's federally regulated, and that's a use-by date for infant formula. Other than that, the dates on food are really just manufacturer suggestions for when a product is at its freshest, when it's at its peak quality. And they're not telling you to throw that food out. They're just telling you, you know, we think it's going to be at its best until then. Oftentimes, food can be in days, weeks, even months after those dates, depending on the food.
Are there people out there who are linking this sort of egregious waste with concerns about feeding the planet in the future?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it all comes together there because the projections of how much food we'll need by 2050 to feed the planet are around 60% more food. And that's both because the population will be growing and also because we have parts of the world where people are becoming more affluent and starting to eat more meat, which is more resource intensive. So kind of requires more land to grow that type of product. And between those, you know, 60% more food, where is that going to come from? And I think looking at this huge source of inefficiency in our food system of product that's not getting eaten is the most obvious answer. In my mind, it's a real parallel to energy efficiency, say, and, you know, changing out your light bulbs for a more efficient light bulb, that we can get the same delicious food and the same experience of that without having to waste so much.
How much of the American household budget is spent on food?
In the U.S., we actually spend very little of our budget on food as compared with other countries. It's around 8%. And when you look at that, you know, it drives less concern and awareness over how much food gets wasted than in other countries. The average American consumer wastes 10 times that of somebody in Southeast Asia, for instance, where food is a much larger portion of their budget. Nevertheless, I mean, the estimate for the average American is that we're spending over $1,500 per household on food that we're not eating. And that's real money that you could be spending on something else.
Thank you so much, Dana.
Thank you. It's been great to speak with you.
That was Dana Gunders. She is food scientist at the National Resources Defense Council. She's been working on this issue of waste for a while now, and she has a new book that's coming out called The Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook. My next guest saw our mountains of food waste and decided to do something about it. As the founder of DC Central Kitchen in Washington, D.C., Robert Egger managed to reduce hunger and provide jobs while minimizing food waste and increasing nutrition in school lunches. After 29 years in D.C., he's landed in L.A., where he plans to implement a similar model. It's called L.A. Kitchen. Hi, Robert.
Hey, how are you?
I'm very excited to have you here. Why don't we start by describing your work at DC Kitchen?
Well, I was a nightclub manager who went out one night to feed the poor and saw charity in America, which was people standing up outside in the rain for a truck to show up every night giving food that was purchased from a grocery store. And I knew how much food we threw away. So I just said, you know, if you could create a central kitchen and collect all that food from restaurants, hotels, hospitals, universities that they hate throwing away, you can feed more people better food for less money. But more importantly, I wanted to get people out of the rain. So this idea of a job training program and this idea of training people. So in effect, the restaurants that donated food could get in return, besides a tax deduction and all that, entry-level people, help make money. Everybody would win. So that was the kind of nexus of it. And it was funny, though. It evolved rapidly to be less about food and more about community. It was – the food thing was such a glorious gateway. And we invited people into our kitchen, and, man, it just took off.
Were the bulk of the donations that came in raw food that needed to be transformed, or a lot of times when people hear about this kind of model, they think about like leftovers from catering jobs?
Well, you know, I made my bones going out at 2 a.m. in D.C. to pick up giant – I mean, it was really unbelievable food that you would get from these massive catered events in the 1980s and 90s. But, you know, I tend to be a little bit of a – you know, I'm a business person. So you know that at the end of the day, all that food that I was building a big empire around was lost profit, and that industry was going to get smarter and smarter and smarter. So we started to diversify and went from prepared food, really started to arc over into going out to the fields and the farms and first getting donations. But then, you know, one of our biggest leaps, offering to buy the unsaleable surplus, the things that are bent, broken, bruised, underripe, overripe, we offered to buy it 10 cents on the dollar and found that there was a tremendous opportunity to get really wholesome stuff before, you know, while we still had time to really make something powerful out of it.
So what made you leave D.C. and come here to L.A.?
Well, I tend to, you know, I mentioned earlier, I tend to be, you know, a business person who looks to see where are the big opportunities. And I'd done really good business in D.C. It was time to pass it on to, you know, just like a chef who suddenly says it's the sous chef's time to run the shop. But there were two big trends I was wildly aware of. Americans throw away about 40% of the food we produce every day. Half of that is fruits and vegetables that are primarily disked under because they're too expensive to bring to market or they're just cosmetically not perfect. And you think about it, LA sits at the bottom of the Central Valley in Ventura. So we're talking about hundreds of millions of pounds of fruits and vegetables, some of the best ever grown that I can get for free or for next to nothing. But more importantly, I'm always aware of who's coming around the bend who's going to need food. And every single morning in America, 10,000 people turn 69. And that's going to go on for the next 20 plus years. And Los Angeles is the home to the largest concentration of older people living in poverty in America. And that's a number that's going to double. And what you can see coming is an army of older people who just aren't going to have enough money in the bank for the extra 10 years science is going to give them. So the idea of not so much how do we feed them, but what fascinates me. This is why I think LA, a town that has often been called the city where the future comes to happen. I came here to be part of the future. And I think this idea of a new era of senior meal programs is going to really be birthed here in LA.
So you're building out this incredibly ambitious space. Where?
Well, it's in Northeast LA. And what's exciting is we're the lead tenant in a building, LA Prep, which will house 50 small business incubators. It's going to be the largest food incubator in America. So this really puts kind of the LA food entrepreneurment movement out front. But we're leasing 20,000 square feet of space. The reality is we're going to be dealing in tractor trailers. And I also know how many people want to be part of this. So whether it's chefs, volunteers, men and women who wanted the job training program, or just demand, the amount of meals that we're going to have to put out on a daily basis to keep up with this rapidly aging Los Angeles population, I had to go bigger than normal. You know, the model I came up with in D.C. had been replicated in about 60 cities. And then another version, which is called Campus Kitchens, which takes advantage of underutilized school cafeterias, that's in 45 cities. So I tend to build things that can be replicated anywhere because I use things that exist pretty much in any town. So while the L.A. kitchen is going to be bigger than anything I've ever done, the idea can and frankly must be considered in every town because every city in America is going to have to wrestle with how do we feed this aging population.
Food waste. Let's get into a little bit some of the nitty-gritty. Who do you get the food from? How do you find them? And then how does the food get from where it is to you?
Well, you know, I think that people assume that I'm going to be doing the restaurant stuff again. And that's just – there's not that, – that industry shifted. So I'm really focusing almost exclusively on Central Valley and Ventura farmers, small family farms that produce a significant amount of waste, again, because it's cosmetically imperfect or below grade. So the idea is – and this is something we pioneered in Washington, D.C. when in partnership with the Obama White House, we did school food. D.C. Central Kitchen was really at the very forefront of locally sourced, cook-from-scratch meals prepared by men and women home from prison. So we want to do the same basic thing here. We have another generous sponsor, CoBank, has underwritten the cost of some pretty significant trucks. So we'll be able to bring it back. Now, the other flip side of this is when you go up Alameda Street, there are, you know, miles of these amazing warehouses. In fact, I was at one recently where the owner was literally weeping at the idea that there were pallets of pineapple that he was said, man, this stuff is ripe today. If I cut it open, it's like candy, but I can't sell it because it's ripe right now. But, you know, what's exciting is, again, this idea of working with programs all over the city who are equally interested, but they've been stuck in this trap where they have to wait for the big Sysco truck to pull up. You know, that's where so much, 60% of institutional food comes from one company in America. So what you have all over is people who want to buy local, they want to buy value-added product, and they want to partner with a program like LA Kitchen that reinvests their money back in LA over and over and over. So whether it's UCLA's dining system, whether it's hospitals, whether it's the school system, whether it's the meal system, but there's millions of dollars in contracts in which the city is buying processed food and the profit leaves town and never comes back. And I'm just going to offer them a beautiful alternative. Again, buy local, keep all the profit local, employ people at a good wage, and provide people with really beautiful, healthy meals.
Robert Egger is the founder and president of LA Kitchen. The operation's expected to open in June of this year. So we've been talking a lot about food waste, which can feel like an overwhelming problem for individuals. But my next guest did it. She decided to make a difference by launching a zero-waste lifestyle. Find out how she did what she did next.
Take KCRW with you on one of our mobile apps. Available for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry devices. Stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and our News 24 and Eclectic 24 streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Americans, you know, we're only 5% of the world population, but we generate 30% of the world's garbage. Each one of us averages 4.4 pounds of trash a day. That's pretty dramatic. As an NYU undergraduate majoring in environmental science, Lauren Singer realized that although she was studying the impacts of waste, she also needed to walk the walk. So she spent the last couple of years leading a zero-waste lifestyle. So what does that mean? Well, she's fit the last 2 years of her personal trash into a 16-ounce mason jar. That's inconceivable to me. And her three-ingredient laundry detergent was recently funded through her Kickstarter campaign. Hi, Lauren.
Hi.
So what was that moment where you realized you had like this massive aha that you were part of the problem?
It all started at NYU, actually. There was a class that I was taking my senior year of college, and there was a girl in my class, and every day she would bring in this plastic bag with a plastic clamshell full of food and plastic silverware and some type of drink in a plastic bottle. And then I watched her doing it repeatedly, and I just got really upset that, you know, someone that was studying environmental science was producing so much garbage. And one day after class, I went home to make dinner and I opened my fridge and I had this like aha moment. And I realized that everything that I had in my refrigerator was packaged in plastic. And I felt like such a hypocrite that I was getting, you know, angry at this girl and I was just as bad, producing just as much waste. So I decided in that moment to quit plastic. So it wasn't just reducing plastic, it was doing things like finding alternatives to everyday items that were packaged in plastic, like toothpaste or deodorant. And while I was researching recipes for these products, I came across a blog called The Zero Waste Home, started by Bea Johnson. She's a wife and mother out in Mill Valley, California, and she lives a zero waste life with her family. And I thought, you know, if a family of four can live without producing trash, I'm only, you know, I was 21 at the time. I figured I can do this too. And so I started the journey.
When you make that switch from buying a product that's in a package like toothpaste to making your own, are you losing efficacy? Are you settling for something less?
I don't think so at all. I actually think I gain a lot when I make my own products because I like to know exactly what's in the products that I'm using. And you know, especially with things like cleaning product manufacturers don't have to list the ingredients of their products on their packaging. So by making my own, I have complete control over what I'm using in my home, what I'm allowing to go near my body, what I'm breathing in. So it's much healthier.
So I remember as a little girl not using toothpaste, but using tooth powder. Is that the kind of thing you're making?
I don't use a tooth powder, but it's very similar to a tooth powder. My toothpaste is only three ingredients. It's organic coconut oil, baking soda, and organic peppermint oil. When I stopped using packaging, the first thing I made was toothpaste.
And what do you do? Keep it in a little jar?
Mm-hmm. I keep it in a little jar, and I have a little metal spoon that I use to scoop it onto my toothbrush.
Okay, so let's talk about going to shop, because when we enter any store that isn't a co-op with tons of stuff in bulk or a farmer's market situation, if we enter a supermarket, we're looking at everything in packaging. So how do you deal with that?
So there are lots of supermarkets that actually offer products in bulk. A lot of international food stores have bulk products, as well as, you know, more natural food stores like Whole Foods or just smaller natural food stores. I buy my vegetables at the farmer's market, but you can also buy them, you know, at normal grocery stores unpackaged. But they do have a produce sticker when you buy it at a grocery store, so that's why I prefer to shop at the farmer's market. And then a lot of these natural food stores will have many products in bulk. So I buy everything from maple syrup to pasta in bulk at my local store.
So one of the things that's intriguing to me listening to you is a lot of what you're talking about happens before you even get into your house.
Yeah, this is something that Bea talks a lot about. But, you know, the first thing that you should do is refuse. So refuse products that are packaged. And that's what I kind of do. If I go into a store, especially the store that I shop at, they have lots of options of, you know, natural packaged foods. And a lot of those will actually be junk food, like cookies and crackers and things that I don't necessarily need. So I say no to those. And if I go shopping, I just buy unpackaged whole food. So, you know, it's a lot healthier. But then once I get home, I have very little waste since I've prepared and I shopped, you know, without packaging. All I really have left is my compost.
So what about, let's say you're buying lamb chops and the lamb chops are wrapped in butcher paper. Do you allow that to come into your house?
I'm a vegetarian, but a lot of stores will actually let you bring your own container. They'll tear or pre-weigh the container and then put the meat in it and then weigh that, give you a price sticker, and then you can have your own packaging.
On your blog, Trashes for Tossers, there's a really powerful image, that image of the mason jar in which you have 2 years of your personal trash. What is inside that jar?
That jar is everything that I haven't been able to compost or recycle over the past 2 years. So that includes things like produce stickers from when I was buying produce at regular supermarkets as opposed to the farmer's market. It has things like when you buy clothing and there's the paper tag and it's connected to the clothing with this little plastic thing. There's a lot of those in there because I shop only secondhand, but even secondhand clothing has tags. So it's things like that. There's a Band-Aid in there. There are some like washing instruction tags from clothing. A lot of those are made from synthetic fabrics, and so you can't compost them or, you know, recycle it in any way. And then a lot of just like little plasticky pieces. So if you buy vitamins, there's the little seal that's on the top of it, you know, to keep it fresh. That's basically it.
It never occurred to me that the produce stickers are not compostable. Why can't you compost those?
Some of them are paper and you can actually compost them, but some of them are made of plastic and you can't.
How do you deal with the issue of toilet paper?
I use toilet paper first and foremost. And the toilet paper industry, actually, a lot of the paper that's used is recycled paper. That's just kind of how the industry works. So I buy a 100% recycled, unbleached toilet paper. And then once I flush it down the toilet, how the wastewater treatment process actually works is that that toilet paper biodegrades, so it doesn't really become a waste product.
I want to talk about your laundry detergent for a minute. So many of the newer washing machines require a lower sudsing product. Does your detergent speak to that need?
It totally does. So my laundry detergent is a powder, and it's only three ingredients, baking soda, washing soda, and organic vegan Castile soap. And it's perfectly safe for both standard and high efficiency washing machines. So it's a really convenient product for any consumer.
What is washing powder?
Washing soda?
Yes.
It's a salt. It helps to remove stains. It's basically the original form of baking soda. So it's kind of like baking soda without the hydrogen.
Thank you so much, Lauren.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. This is really fun.
That was Lauren Singer. Her blog is Trash is for Tossers. And now we're off to the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Market manager Laura Avery's there with her weekly report on what's fresh and in season this last weekend in February.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Sure sign of spring is when the Zuckerman asparagus from the Sacramento Delta area comes back to the farmers markets. I think it's a tiny bit early this year, and I'm talking to Juan Acevedo, who is the man who comes down every year with the Zuckerman asparagus. He's got beautiful asparagus on the table, and Juan, I couldn't help but notice the purple asparagus is not here yet. But can you tell us about how the asparagus grows up there and what you brought in today?
Well, we grow asparagus. Well, my boss grows asparagus in North Sacramento area. Nice place. A lot of rivers up there. It's why asparagus is very tender and delicate stuff. It's why it's great flavor. Different in other places in the meadow, like Fresno, Bakersfield. It's too hot in the summer. And North is cold in the winter. Great for asparagus.
Right. And so today you kind of have the medium and the small.
Yes.
But my understanding was the first asparagus that grows is the jumbo asparagus. So what's happening with that?
Jumbo come later. First, standard size, medium size, and large. But later, in 2 or 3 weeks more, starting jumbos.
And is the flavor different with the jumbo?
Oh, excellent flavor. Sweeter than the other sizes, too. This is more younger plants. It's about 3 years old in the fields. This is why it's more sweeter and more tender. This is younger plants.
So you're saying the jumbo is a three-year-old plant?
Yeah, 3 years old in the fields.
Okay.
After 7 years, cut off and put new plants again. It's why every season is the best quality. It's why. We never keep old plants in the fields like 10, 12 years in the fields. It's why.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then tell us about the purple asparagus.
Purple, sweeter, and the green, always. It's a more delicate labor too. Flavor different for sure. But the shorter season every year too, like 5 or 6 weeks only every year. The best things, the best products are shorted, no?
Right, they don't last.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So you said this purple is a special, has to be handled specially?
Especially, yes.
How?
Yeah, well, special labor, special guys planted and take care.
Are you one of those special guys?
No, I'm selling here.
You got the easier job,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. Yeah, easy. Well, delicate job too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Juan. So you just now started. You're down in LA with this wonderful Delta Zuckerman asparagus. Mm-hmm. What is your season going to be this year, do you think?
Normal season is to February to May.
All right. Well, good. Well, so glad you're back.
Thank you.
That was Juan Acevedo, and he comes down with the Zuckerman asparagus every year. The season has just begun, and hopefully it will last all the way to May. We're talking now with Zach Jarrett. He's the chef de cuisine at Squirrel in Silver Lake. And Zach, you're here at the market. We're on the cusp of spring. You're always inspired working with Jessica over there at Squirrel. So tell me what you're shopping for, what you're finding, and what you're going to be making.
So in addition to the stuff for our core menu, we have a daily changing board with specials. And that board's determined by what's seasonal and kind of what ideas strike our fancy. It's a very collaborative kitchen. So today I'm looking for radishes, green garlic, spinach, peas, kind of the new bright green things that introduce the spring vegetables to our lineup. Today in particular, we're doing a dish that's kind of a play between like an American tuna noodle casserole and also like a pasta carbonara. So we took like beautiful oil poached tuna that we did at the restaurant, and we're going to do pappardelle, pea tendrils, the English peas and snap peas, and kind of mount everything together with fresh egg yolks into this hybrid in-between that, to me, is like something I grew up eating, but is actually based on a traditional carbonara dish I cooked at a different restaurant, and blends lots of classic flavors and lots of very fresh, vibrant vegetables together.
When you say egg yolk on the carbonara, how is that put together?
So when I do carbonara, you basically start to cook all the vegetables together. So we're going to take a little bit of pancetta. We'll take the sliced snap peas, some garlic, and some shallots, and we start to sweat that. Then the pasta is tossed in that mix, and everything's put into a bowl that has egg yolks, Parmesan cheese, and black pepper. And then we kind of cook that almost like a double boiler on the stove itself, tossing it until it's coated. And right before it goes on the plate, we put the pea tendrils, which just barely wilt before it's put down on the plate. So still lots of texture and lots of height.
And the egg white is just not involved at all.
Right. They're separated to order. So you're just putting egg yolks and cheese in the bowl to start the sauce. And then the heat of the pasta cooks the egg yolks just enough to coat it and make a sauce.
And you said radishes. Radishes seem to be more of a perennial kind of a thing, but I know that there's so many different kinds. Mm-hmm. And then we've all been kind of watching and waiting for the peas to show up. So you've already found them.
Yeah, so, you know, farms like Windrose and Coleman have been growing lots of beautiful peas, and California is lucky to have a pea season that kind of starts mid-January. English peas are the last to come out, but the tendrils and the snap peas come first. For radishes, I think at Squirrel, we love really peppery, bold flavors, lots of like crunch and acidity. So both the colors of the daikon radishes now, the honeydew radish, the purple daikons, and the watermelon radish, which have been really popular this season, are great. And then also black radishes, which we've been using in pickles and on the sorrel pesto rice bowl, which is one of the signature things we do. They rotate through, and they're all pretty unique and special to us.
Great, fantastic. Well, that dish sounds wonderful, and it's nice to be celebrating spring with so many different flavors. So thank you so much, Zach.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you guys.
Nice to talk to you. That was Zach Jarrett. He's the sous chef at Squirrel Cafe over in Silver Lake, clearly enjoying everything that's happening at spring right now at the farmer's market. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Asparagus, peas, and tendrils. We'll let you know what's happening each week at the Farmers Market on our Instagram feed. Follow us at KCRW Good Food. Jonathan Gold's in the studio next, so stick around for A Taste of Terrain. That's next.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW radio.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Jonathan Gold is here. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. And today we're off to Terrain on Beverly Boulevard. Fair warning, this is one meaty menu.
There's a lot of charcuterie, and a lot of it is made by the chef Chris Morningstar, who we've seen at the restaurant at LACMA. He was at Patina Restaurants for a while. He's been knocking around LA restaurants for decades.
It's a very large menu. How did you approach it?
It's not the easiest menu to approach. In some ways, it is hors d'oeuvres and main plates. I mean, you can do just two courses, which has become so hard to do at places in town, right? It's all about sharing plates. Of course, as a matter of course, you're going to end up using everything as sharing plates anyway, but at least there's a nod in that direction. And it's trying to be sort of a traditional French bistro or brasserie, sort of a casual place where you go and maybe get, you know, a slice of terrine or some head cheese and a good glass of wine. It's sort of a tour of provincial French cooking in a way that people kind of haven't done here for a while. So you can get a bowl of garbure, which is one of my favorite French soups from the Southwest. It's what you do with your leftover confit, if you should have to have some leftover confit, with, you know, vegetables and beans and ham and carrots that are sort of sautéed in duck fat and then simmered in duck broth. It's a very, very ducky dish. And when you're halfway through, they give you this little bowl of red wine. And the waiter says, you know, it's time to faire un chabrol, which means pour the red wine into the soup to be like a goat. And that's kind of delicious too. It's like two different soups in one.
And it's such a convivial, familial kind of thing to do when you're eating, because you have a glass of red wine and then you're just tippling it in to change the flavor towards the end.
Yeah, I've always thought that it was sort of a halfway rude thing to do, that it's something you'd only do at home. But it's nice to sort of be nudged in that direction at a restaurant.
So should we start out with the terrines?
Maybe. We have not had a lot of foie gras in California for a few years. And I don't think I was ever in the habit of ordering foie gras terrines anyway, but the idea of seeing one on a menu was somehow irresistible. And it was a really good one. I mean, the texture was perfect, like super smooth, like almost aerated but not quite, really creamy, a lot of sort of straight-ahead foie flavor, really nicely seasoned.
So for people who still, even though it's legal to eat it, are going to shun the foie, what other kinds of terrines is he making?
There's a country terrine, which is, you know, rough-cut pork. There's a – I guess it's not technically a terrine, but it's rillette, which is, you know, the pork and the duck with the fat over it. It's very, very rich to spread onto a toasted baguette.
It seems like it would be hard to move on from these.
You could go there and you could eat terrines and appetizers and yeah, it would be great.
But let's talk about the main dishes. What did you get?
They have boudin blanc, which is really actually emulsified. It's kind of bouncier than they tend to be here, which is served with pureed parsnips and some slices of apple that have been sautéed in some vinegar. There's a choucroute, a big old plate of sauerkraut with all the stuff on it. And Los Angeles never quite feels like a choucroute town, right? It's just
– it's not cold enough.
It's not cold enough. And – then this is L.A., so you have to have Italian stuff. So there's, you know.
But it seems so weird.
I know.
Menu.
I'm not sure why you would order the squid ink spaghetti, and I'm not really sure why you would order the agnolotti, though they're pretty good agnolotti, very mushroomy. I think you're probably going to want to, like, you know, stick to the terrines, to the little fish dishes, and that garbure is so good.
I see on the menu they have crepinette.
Crepinette are kind of great. They're something you used to see all the time you haven't seen in a while. I guess it's the leaf fat from around the kidney that's used as a wrapping for like a forcemeat, a kind of sausage in this case. And then it's seared off and the fat like almost disappears and what you're left with is – you know, this nice sort of gently spiced, heavily emulsified sausage.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about terrine on Beverly Boulevard. Text the words good food to 69866 to get a text with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes. LA has never been a fine dining town. I think of it more as a fine eating town. But lately, fine eating seems to be replacing fine dining to create a whole new category of more casual restaurants with highly considered food. The trend is happening everywhere, from Paris to New York. So what's going to happen to those jewel box fine dining restaurants that have for years ruled the heap in big restaurant towns? Late last year, Eater New York's restaurant critic Ryan Sutton reviewed Per Se, Thomas Keller's restaurant at the Time Warner Center. His restaurant review read like one long sigh. The cuisine was tired, the luxury subdued, and it all cost what some of us might pay in a month's rent. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, how you doing, Evan?
Good. How far into the meal were you when you realized that the review wasn't going to be a rave?
I think I realized it was during my second of two meals, one meal for the chef's tasting and the second meal for the chef's vegetable tasting. It was during the second meal, probably after the Amuse course, where I realized things weren't going to go very well at all. It was a soup course. I believe it was a parsnip soup. It was heavily fortified with either cream or butter. And, you know, it's funny. The nice thing about a soup Amuse, it's usually just one or two sips or three or four sips just to get you ready to wet your palate for the rest of the meal. But I remember having almost 11 sips, and it was leaden soup. And it did the exact opposite of what a traditional Amuse should do. It usually gets you ready for the meal, but this Amuse made me want to, you know, leave the restaurant and take a long night's sleep during the cold weather. It was the exact opposite of what one expected from a fine dining restaurant.
And what's so interesting is for years how Thomas Keller himself would explain why he loved to do these tasting menus was that he always wanted to leave you where you wanted one more bite.
That is precisely why Thomas Keller is so important for the United States fine dining pantheon. Open up the French Laundry cookbook and they explain it. You know, Thomas Keller calls it the law of diminishing returns. You have like 16 bites of a pork chop and by the 12th or 13th bite, your palate is tired of it. He wants you to, like you said, you wish you had one more bite of each and every single course, and then it's taken away, and another course appears, and it creates that constant state of want, of desire, and it's almost of an instant nostalgia. What happened to the last course? But we have another one coming up ahead of us. But it seems that Keller has actually fallen behind the times in that very subjective ratio. At per se, it's still a long menu. It's about 9 formal courses. You end up getting about 11 to 12. But when we think of modern fine dining restaurants in New York right now, we think no longer of per se. We think of longer tasting menu restaurants like the Chef's Table at Brooklyn Fair, anywhere from 15 to 30 courses, or a Terra in Tribeca, 20 to 25 courses, Blanca in Bushwick, 25 to 30 courses, just one or two bites in every course, and then moving to the next one. And that's what gets a lot of us excited.
It's also it seems also that you can't separate your reaction to the space as well, that the actual white tablecloth situation where you have tons of real estate around you might actually be old school as well.
Correct. To be fair, it is a quintessentially lovely thing to be sitting in Per Se's dining room, which is still one of New York's great dining rooms. The view is almost unparalleled. You're overlooking Columbus Circle and Central Park South. The question is, though, do you really need to be paying for that real estate? Just as you were talking about in the introduction, how a lot of contemporary dining is not about fine dining, but about fine eating. I call it budget gourmet dining, you know, having high-end food in certain stripped-down spaces. The fine dining world is becoming like the fine eating world as well. We're not eating with white tablecloths. We're eating around a chef's counter. And instead of having, you know, maybe traditional luxury ingredients, we're having something else. You know, the new luxury to me is about super dry aged meats. It's about arcane vegetables. It's about offal. It's about not necessarily strictly vegetarian menus. It's about restaurants like Manresa, where it's a largely vegetable menu seasoned with little bits of meat and fish just to give it that extra bit of umami and roundness. And again, not to go off on a separate, you know, diatribe, but that's another reason why Per Se hasn't really kept up with the times.
So was this review hard to write? Were you nervous about the reaction?
Of course. I mean, you know, there's a certain belief that food writers love to take down restaurants. I don't think that's ever the case. I mean, we all love to write and we all love to eat. And, you know, we're all happy about, you know, the product that we put out on a week-to-week basis. But it's scary and it's you know, I hope this doesn't sound self-aggrandizing. It's a big risk to criticize a hugely important restaurant. And Per Se is a hugely important restaurant. Like I said, it really introduced New Yorkers to the modern age of, or at least one of the modern ages of fine dining. Thomas Keller really has set the bar higher, not just for restaurants and the clients who visit them, but he's created not just wealth, but great chef jobs and great chefs for other restaurants in New York. It really is a hub of the chef community, and we all have to be grateful for that. But like I said, you know, the restaurant wasn't up to snuff when I reviewed it, and it's simply not evolving like restaurants like Blue Hill at Stone Barns are or Momofuku Ko are. It per se needs to evolve, and it certainly has the capacity and the money and the client base to be able to take the risk to do that. But again, back to the original point, I was hugely scared before I put this out, and it was nice to hear a lot of you know, the voices in the chef's community, both privately and publicly, you know, give me a little backup for this one. And so yeah, that was tough, but I'm glad it came out the way it did.
Is criticism in print versus criticism on the web a different animal? Is there something inherently different about them? Is it easier to be honest when the words aren't actually inked on a piece of paper?
I'm not entirely sure, but one thing I know I'm incredibly grateful about in my capacity as working for Eater is that I get to make these fun little interactive charts about prices. And so I can build an online graph that tells you how much dinner is going to be at 11 Madison Park based on whether you get the wine pairing or not, or based on whether you get some of the supplements at Per Se or all of the supplements at Per Se. And that's the nice thing about being online. It's not just about a comment section. It's about building interactivity. And one of the things that we can do at Vox right now, which is the parent company of Eater, where I work, is that we're beginning to annotate our reviews. And so I can go to a Robert Sietsema review. He's our other critic. And if I disagree with whatever he has to say, I can make a little comment, not at the bottom of the comments, but like a little annotation right in the text itself. And the user can click on that and they can see my take on that. So again, it's not simply about comments. It's about making things more interactive. It's about having a more dynamic review rather than something that's out there in print and that's there to stay. It's something that's it's something that's alive. It's something that can move. It's simply a better way to read and a better way to, you know, interact with criticism.
Thank you very much, Ryan.
Thank you.
Ryan Sutton is one of the restaurant critics at Eater New York. We've been talking about his review of Per Se and what it means to have a contemporary fine dining or fine eating experience. Did you know that Good Food will be going to South by Southwest this year? We're going to be podcasting live from the Driscoll Hotel during South Bites on Sunday, March 15th. If you're at the festival, come by and say hi. On Monday the 16th, I'll also be moderating a panel on food criticism in the digital age with Jonathan Gold, Allison Cook of the Houston Chronicle, and Helen Rosner of Eater.com. Check out the Good Food blog for all the details. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food On Demand on KCRW's smartphone app. Thanks to everyone who makes Good Food possible. That is Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll be back next week with more Good Food.